sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China continuing to slow. Spain bailout is imminent. Markets are definitely not in equilibrium, and we have a great guest with us today. His name is David Wessel, and he wrote the book that is called Red Ink. We're going to get to him and lots more on this episode, number 282 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And here we are in the beginning of October 2012. It's the first week of the month. And we had quite an exciting month before us and a good overall market condition, although it was a little bit choppy towards the end of the month. As a matter of fact, a lot of distribution went on in the last week, and we'll have to see really what goes on in terms of the eventual trend right now, because what we've seen is that there has been a lot of buying, and at the same time, towards the end, when a lot of the headwinds really start to come to the fore and when they start to collide, come together, between the high gas prices and oil prices we saw recently and the high food prices, as well as things, we can just go over a list if you want. I mean, things like the upheaval in the Middle East. We see China slowing down, European situation getting worse, the U.S. economy starting to really show some signs, especially in the manufacturing area, of a slowdown. And the list goes on and on. But basically, you add that to the fact that we're getting towards the presidential election in the U.S. and the fiscal cliff. Boy, there's a lot of things that really investors have to kind of ponder and look at. And if you're looking at all that exclusively, you would say, man, what the heck am I doing? On the other hand, if you look at the trend and the overall direction of prices, you'd say, well, maybe things aren't that bad. Of course, on the other hand, you may see, why are people ignoring this? Why are investors ignoring the fact that we're seeing a whole host of companies that are guiding their outlook down? Analysts are downgrading and taking down price targets and EPS targets much greater than they're upgrading them. And we're seeing things like Caterpillar and Nike and the global companies really start to really speak up to the fact that they're seeing China and many other areas around the world starting to show some signs of concern. So we have a lot of that going on, these cross currents, and it makes for, I would say at best, a confusing time. So that's where you really got to sit down and focus on disciplines. We talked about that last week at length with Scott O'Neill from MarketSmith. Hopefully you got your trial of MarketSmith last week. And, you know, we look at the outlook right now, and we see a very mixed and probably a outlook that most of us could say could go either way. When it comes to the economy, we definitely see some pockets of slowdown that are affected by a whole host of issues. We see the employment situation starting to get concerning and really, you know, again, slow down. But at the same time, many stocks are holding up very well. Apple did roll over, and we'll see if that's going to hold. Maybe it's because of the maps. Maybe it's because of the euphoria. Maybe it's because they didn't sell as many as they expected the first week. Maybe analyst expectations were too high. We're seeing Google, on the other hand, do very well. So, you know, I got to tell you, it's one of those times, again, that you got to step back and really consider all the different things. Be nimble, but really focus on those things that are working and ditch the things that aren't. What I thought we'd do today is, once again, I know a lot of you like to focus on the things that are coming up, the things that are going to affect markets over the next week or so, and talk about some of the things that we need to pay attention to. I also want to mention some of the stocks, or at least the targets for stock markets that are very important to be watching right now. We have them very much, very clearly defined, and we can see where they are, where the breakdown, breakup points are, and those things you need to write down and you need to make sure that you pay attention to if you are, in fact, trading overall markets. You know, then we could break that down to sectors and stocks, et cetera. But right now, there are some very important levels that you need to be watching for. Let's first kick it off by talking about what's going on next week, what we have to look for in terms of the economics. Now, first of all, it's the beginning of a new month. It's the beginning of a new quarter. Maybe Thursday's move of the markets was a simple window dressing markup period. Then again, maybe it was just a quick relief rally from a little bit of an oversold situation. But coming into this week, what happens is oftentimes you see a lot of pension funds and a lot of investors looking at the last quarter of the year, the first week of the new quarter, as a time to invest some money that they have accumulated. So, for example, we see that pension funds will redeploy assets that they've collected from, let's say, 401k plans that have to be invested in or pension plans that have to be invested in. And again, they have parameters of where they're going to invest, and that's been set up in advance. It's not like they're going to change it all of a sudden, although they may. But, you know, what we've seen is an exit since the Fed came out with their QE3, where they're going to be buying into mortgage securities. We've seen quite the exit, a bit of an exodus from the long-term bonds on the Treasury side. You watch TLT and see how that rolled over, although when the markets start getting a little bit bumpy, that gets kicked in again. But clearly there was a signal right there that people looking to move out of the longer-term maturities and into some other options, and we see that mortgage rates are now the lowest they've been on record, and a lot of that is due to, thank you very much, Mr. Bernanke. So that's going to obviously help out, let's say, the housing market. We saw the Case-Shiller month, the numbers last month, the 20 city year over year do very nicely. Home builders are happy. New home sales are doing okay. Existing home sales are doing much better. And overall, we're seeing that home builder stocks have been on a tear and things related to that. Take a look at a stock called Sherwin-Williams, the paint company, Home Depot, Lennar. I mean, you look at these companies and you're seeing a dramatic move to the upside, and it's been consistent, sustained, and for some of these has been very steady. The weekly stock chart on Sherwin-Williams is, you got to look at that. It's like just a 45-degree angle, nice and slow, a nice slope, just ever so gently higher week after week. Really kind of amazing if you think about it. Could it be that the idea that the stabilization in the housing market has taken hold? Well, I think so. Clearly, we're not back to anywhere near where we were before the whole thing kind of came crashing down. But at the same time, things are better and stabilizing, so a lot of investors want to get in there. The home builders have really cut back dramatically. They're doing a lot of things to clean up not only their balance sheets, but the way that they do business. And some of these companies are doing pretty darn well, I got to tell you. Pretty impressive. Well, let's talk about some of the eco that's coming up, okay? Now, we saw over the weekend that China's numbers came out soft in terms of the HSBC manufacturing, and we're going to see kind of what the ultimate, we'll say, kind of reaction to much of this is. There's still a lot of hope for stimulus, although they have been signaling that they're not going to come out with a massive stimulus plan in China. Already they did some infrastructure spending. They did spending we saw 2 weeks ago and actually a week before that on subways and railroads and some roads and some of their very, very, very specific targets that they did. That's going to be good. But they're seeing inflation in the housing market, and they're still trying to slow down the overall prices, and they're trying to slow down the loans in, you know, the whole country. That comes on the heels of a real contraction when it comes to manufacturing. Now, in the U.S., we saw some numbers come out. We saw durable goods, one of the worst numbers that I've seen in years, a minus 13 on that number. But, of course, you take out some of the transportation, you do a few things. It was still pretty bad. Durable goods have been slowing down and in the negative territory over the last several months. And that is consistent with what we're seeing around the world. We're seeing that there is a slowdown in manufacturing and in exports from Japan and China, Europe, United States, emerging markets. It is consistent across the board. Let's not just throw that out to a simple as they would say, soft patch. Let's look at that in the context of what's going on with austerity and the continuation of austerity and major efforts to contain the debt problem in Europe, a major trading partner of all the places we just mentioned, and that is throwing exports and manufacturing into a tailspin. There's no question about that. Now, what can be done about that? Well, there's things to offset that. For example, the bringing down the value of the dollar, that can help our exports here. The yen just continues to climb, even though Japan threatens on a consistent basis to have very active and very substantial intervention in that currency market, but it doesn't seem to help. Now, you got to wonder. I mean, seriously, think about this. We know that Japan has the highest debt of any country in the world. We know that their economy is aging. We know that their economy is slowing. We know that it's very much related to China and Asia and Europe. At the same time, you would just think that by the very nature of economics, that the yen should be moving down in value. When you look at the valuation of a currency, you have to look at the backdrop of what their economy is doing. But yet the yen continues to advance. Why is that? Well, the reason you have to think is one thing only. It's the continuation of a quote-unquote safety trade. Now, when I say that, the safety trade and the yen, and I say that right after I talk about how poorly their economy is doing, the excessive amount of debt that they have, the aging economy, and the outlook, you have to say, wait a minute, that makes no sense. And I agree with you. I totally agree with you. It makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. The fact that the yen continues to climb is one of those strange kind of, oddball economic situations that is more of it is than the reality of what it should be. Now, over time, that will correct itself, whether it's now, in a month, in a year, with or without intervention. Eventually, things catch up to normal. Reversion to the mean, we'll call it, or bringing back normality, equilibrium to a market condition. But right now, it's not that. Right now, there's the reality that in the U.S., there is going to be a continuation of low interest rates for some time. The reality that in Europe, they're going to continue with austerity and that the euro is going to be propped up by a variety of areas. And emerging markets, well, they'll kind of bob and sway dependent on the overall environment of the developed world. So now, when we look at the economics and what we're looking at for next week in the U.S., which the world looks at, we have to realize that we have things like the ISM manufacturing coming out on Monday, expectations for a contraction again at the 49.8 level. Below 50 is contraction, above 50 is expansion. We have vehicle sales coming out. We have the ADP employment numbers coming out Wednesday. We have the non-manufacturing number, which has been holding up very well. In other words, the service area holding up very well. We have, and they're expecting about 53.5 on that, and that's about the same as last month. We have initial claims. Last week, we saw a very good number, 359, first kind of sub 370 in a while. Looking for that to pop up to 370 again. We have factory orders looking at a negative 5.5% number. That's concerning. And the reason for that is we have seen inventories on the rise and sales not keeping pace with the inventory. So whether or not inventories are rising because sales are not happening, or we have inventories rising because we've seen that manufacturers have been too optimistic, however you want to slice this, what has been forcing the inventory to sales ratio higher, the fact of the matter is that when you see that happen, factories start to slow down. Now, you're coming into the holiday season, and usually that's time that inventories start to really get very much in line with sales, but sales are slowing, even though we've seen consumer confidence rising. Matter of fact, last week, the conference board put out their consumer confidence. It was like 8 points higher than expectations, and that was really good. The final number on the University of Michigan was a little bit lighter than expectations, but still, it was pretty high. So there's a disparity, a disconnect between what consumers are feeling and saying and what they're actually doing, it seems. Of course, we have the FOMC minutes coming out during the week. We also have the big NFP payrolls number. Expectations are for a 8.2% unemployment rate, and we're looking for a 115 non-farm payroll number. Now, that comes on the heel of 96,000 when expectations were in about 150 last month. Now, remember something. Analysts bob and sway and kind of reevaluate according to the trend. And, you know, they thought things were a lot better because the ADP number came out at 200,000. But then the fact was that the real unemployment rate, quote unquote, by the powers that be at the NFP came in a lot lighter. We'll see what that's going to be. We'll see how we're gonna actually really look at the unemployment situation coming in towards the end of the year. Now, with the initial claims, which is a bit of a leading indicator, you would expect that you'll see somewhat about the same numbers as we saw last month. It would be very interesting to see anything different. And with the fact that you have the fiscal cliff and the worries by companies and the outlook that they've been giving, you know what? The fact is that we probably are on the reverse of what we've seen recently, which was a better unemployment situation or better employment situation, probably going to start to roll over a bit here. So we're going to look at that. Looking at average hourly earnings, looking at the change in household employment, the unemployment rate, and of course, the last thing we'll see, 3 o'clock on next Friday, is the consumer credit, which shrank dramatically, meaning that people were not putting on more credit. And that's something that's good to help out their balance sheets, the personal balance sheets, but it's bad when it comes to the fact that you see what consumers are actually doing. Now, what's happening with the market? Well, we saw that there was a break of the S&P 500. Let's focus on the S&P 500 for a second. There's some very important levels that we need to consider. Now, with the distributions that we saw last week and institutions starting to sell, we don't know quite yet if that was simply a reallocation trade, if that was a just a simple moving in and out of different positions that would be desirous to hold on their books at the end of the quarter when they have to report. We're not quite sure what it is yet. So let's not get ahead of things. Let's take the trend, which is right now still in an uptrend, with an asterisk that says, you know what? Caution is advisable. We saw the VIX move up over the last couple of weeks. We talked about that about 2 weeks ago. I said, hey, watch the VIX here because we're seeing some really low levels. It did drop down again to a pretty low level on Thursday, but then pop right back up on Friday. So we're going to continue to watch the fear gauge or the protection gauge that investors will use to offset some of their potential risk in their portfolios. But right now, when we look at the markets and we look at whether or not we're in the overheated or the oversold or possibly even in equilibrium, clearly right now we're bearing on the oversold level by just a small amount. Fact is that markets are not in equilibrium. So what do we have to look for? Here are some of the targets that you need to pay attention to. 1439, right about where the S&P closed on Friday, is a very key level. Now, we saw a wide range on Friday. We saw a drop down about 12 points, come all the way back, and towards the end, they just chopped it right back down again. We've seen a lot of that lately. End-of-day movement that is kind of out. They don't want to be in for any major announcements that may come out to the detriment of equities. 1439, pay attention to that level, closing under that level. From there, you have a target of 1425. 1411, I want you to inscribe that somewhere. 1411 is a very good support line. Now, whether or not we see a lot more that is distributions beyond that and a lot more selling beyond that, but right now, for short-term trading concepts and for kind of looking for reversal points, if we see a level of 1411, there is a very good key support line with very high volume that goes back some time. So I want you to write that down. 1439, 1425, 1411. 1425 is a weak support level. 1411 is a very strong level. 1439 is the kind of core level that we're looking at right now. Now, if you see a breakdown below that, there is some air pockets there that we did see that last week. Did you notice if you watched on an intraday basis, once you broke that 1439, kind of quickly moved down 2-3 points. Not a big deal, not an air pocket that's kind of like, you know, a 10-point air pocket, but enough to really put some pressure on stocks at that level. And if you notice, there was a high correlation of stocks overall to the futures and the S&P itself, showing that there's broad-based selling of futures, ETFs, and broad-based buying of futures and ETFs. So pay attention to that. 1439, 1425, 1411. Target of 1411 for a reversal bounce at that level. And if you can, if you're looking to do some trading of that, that's a point that you should be looking for. Now, above that, we have, you know, different levels also, but there looks like, you know, the substantial point is the support levels that you need to be concerned with right now, because we are seeing that sellers are in a bit of control right now and we're leaning towards the oversold, but not enough to be at a point that it's like wicked upside all of a sudden, unless something dramatic happens on the economic front, the announcement front, the Fed front, the central bank front, or something. So we call that markets not in equilibrium, and you have to look for where those support points are. Utilize your smart stops where, you know, you're going to find important levels of support for individual stocks. And that those could, you know, those could break down very easily. Look at some of the stocks last week that did break down and rolled over. But, you know, with Apple leading the market because it's such a huge component of the market, you have to watch Apple also as an indication of risk sentiment. We have earnings that are going to be starting on the 11th. I believe it's the 11th for Alcoa. That's the official start of earnings season. Woohoo! Last quarter earnings season. Now, I've been kind of fetching and complaining that I thought margins were going to be compressing on stocks for a while and, you know, that earnings were questionable. You have to remember something. It's all in relation to expectations. Now, what we saw was analysts drop down estimates pretty low at the end of the previous quarter, and a lot of companies beat, and that was very good. Question is going to be, how much lower are they going to be able to drop expectations at this point for the level that you have on the equities at this point? Now, a lot of companies have been saying that their outlook was questionable, very foggy, don't have as much, you know, ability to see what's happening in the future. But at the same time, you have to realize that what we're finding is, in the U.S. at least, these companies are still doing a very good job of managing their overall inventories, of managing expectations, and of really pulling a rabbit out of their hat in terms of their current earnings. EPS has been kind of on, but you have to look at the revenue side of things. Revenue has been falling short. Again, the latest one we saw was with Nike last week, and Nike came out with a beat on revenues, a beat on EPS, but they said, you know, moving forward, we saw that sales were down. We expected 10% growth of sales in the future orders for China. They came in at 8%. And they said, you know, things weren't going to be so great. Well, Nike broke down by about 3 or 4% through the session and then closed about 1% down, came all the way back to the unchanged area. Because, again, Nike is one of those stocks that investors love. And they think that, hey, if things get better, you know, while there is margin compression at this point, well, you know, we're going to see things that are going to be getting better, and I'd rather be in it at this point than not. But pay attention because, you know, we didn't see it as a good number for Nike, not at all. Matter of fact, it was a discouraging number. We were short Nike into the earnings, and actually when it came down towards the support point, we said, you know what, it's not breaking down here, and we closed the position. Now, we may reopen the position when reality hits here because that will be a stock that will be hit if there is continued weakness in China and overseas. So just keep a look on that. And I think the other thing to notice and to recognize is it's okay if you're in a position to stop out of it and then to move back if it's confirmed moving in the direction that you believed. It's okay to do that. Now, before we get to our guest, I want to mention that we have Mark Faber, the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report coming up next week. And we also have Das. I just spoke to him recently. He's going to be coming on in a couple of weeks as well. But let's get to the next section here of our podcast and our episode. David Wessel is our guest, and he's the author of a book that's out that's pretty interesting. It's called Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the federal budget. Actually, there's another line that says where the trillions come from, where they go, and why inaction imperils our future. So, David, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. Listen, so I got a lot of questions to ask you. Now, one of the things that you talk about in the book is the whole idea of, obviously, how much money is being spent in a ridiculous manner and what people probably don't know about how much is being spent. But doesn't that all start with the premise that there would be some kind of a budget plan, some kind of a something that should be set up that at least somebody knows what's being spent?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the point of my book is that a lot of money is being spent in a ridiculous manner, although some of it obviously
okay.
is.
All right.
If it were being spent in a ridiculous manner, it would be easier to deal with the deficit.
Right.
You know, a lot of the money that the government spends, in fact, more than half, goes into the federal government and then goes out again, much of it in the form of benefits of some kind. So that's point one. Point two, yes, you're absolutely right. Now, we know where the money goes. I have here a book called The Historical Tables, Budget of the U.S. Government, which tells me where the money went for each of the last 100 years, including and has estimates for the current year. But I think what you're alluding to is that it's a little bit like flying an airplane without having any kind of route map.
Mm-hmm.
That what Congress has done is, despite their own law that they passed in 1974, failed to come up with a kind of budget blueprint that says, this is how much money we intend to spend on this, this is how much money we intend to spend on that, this is how much we expect to get on taxes, so that the Congress gets a coherent whole as to the idea of where it goes. Instead, they've done everything on an ad hoc basis. The benefits are paid because the law requires them to be paid. There's no annual oversight of them. And they scurry around to come up with spending bills so that they can keep the government functioning. They just did one, but it only covers the government through the first 6 months of the fiscal year because they couldn't agree on how to do it for the whole year.
I guess I'm so mystified how we can actually, as a country, be spending money without any plan of what those amounts should be and the parameters of what they go to from a lack of a budget.
Let's think about this. So, the Congressional Budget Office or the White House Budget Office can tell us, this is what we're going to spend on Medicare this year. This is what we're going to spend on Social Security. This is what we're going to spend on veterans. This is what we're going to spend on interest on the federal debt. So it's not like they don't know. It's just that those payments are automatic. The government has passed laws promising to pay them, and the money goes out the door without any kind of a annual authorization from Congress. The other money, the third of the federal government that goes to pay for everything from bullets and the guns of the soldiers in Afghanistan to the woman who's in charge of making sure that the bears don't wander onto the highway at Yellowstone,
mm-hmm.
all those operations of the federal government, Congress passes legislation. Those people don't get paid. The bullets don't get bought unless Congress passes an appropriation bill, and Congress has done that for half the year. So it's not like they don't know where the money's going. What they aren't doing is saying, okay, look, we got a problem here. We spend a lot more money than we take in. And it's okay for now because we can borrow really cheaply and we have a lousy economy. It's not a great long-term strategy. None of them up there say it's a great long-term strategy. Then you say to them, okay, what's the 5-year plan? How much do you think we should be collecting in taxes? How much should we be spending on health care? Where should we be spending less money? And there they say, oh, you know, it's all after the election.
Right,
so
right.
So that's where we are.
Right. So this annual deficit that we have that goes on and that obviously adds to the amount of debt that we have outstanding,
right.
It seems to be, obviously, from every encounter and everything that you look at and read and from what I see, it's unsustainable, quote unquote. But yet, again, it's unsustainable when? Is it unsustainable now or is it unsustainable sometime in the future if interest rates move? And obviously, the Fed is doing everything they can to keep interest rates down. Where do you see this whole thing breaking down?
Well, it is sustainable now in the sense that the government of the United States is borrowing extraordinary amounts of money every week and paying interest rates that are as low as any time in my lifetime, and I'm 58 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the question is about today, and that's what makes it so hard to solve. If the U.S. Treasury were in the unfortunate position of the finance ministry of, say, Spain or Italy or, God forbid, Greece,
mm-hmm.
where they couldn't borrow except at 7, 8, 10% interest rates, if at all, then that we would have a crisis and they might have to do something about it. So it's definitely the case that it's unsustainable for some point in the future. When is that day going to come? I have no idea. Planning on it going on forever is unwise. Let me give you one, but I think people have a hard time understanding this sometimes. One of the things that strikes me as a way to explain to people is, as you pointed out, interest rates are very low now. The federal government's borrowing at something like 1.8% for 10 years. So last year, at low interest rates, the government spent $235 billion on interest. That was more than it spent on the Departments of Commerce, Energy, Education, Homeland Security, Interior, Justice, and State, plus the federal courts, all combined.
Wow.
6% of the federal budget. The president's budget says, the document that the president put out in February says, if you look ahead 5 years, and if the economy does pretty well by the end of that five-year period, because they have a reasonably optimistic economic forecast here, and if Congress took every single proposal that the president has made on taxes and spending, those that he put forward in February, then in 2017, interest would be 12% of all federal spending.
Wow.
So that's one way to show people that this isn't sustainable. That's saying that even if the economy does well, because interest rates, as you point out, will rise, because we're such a big borrower, it's like having an adjustable rate mortgage, we're going to spend more and more money on interest, and that means less and less money for everything else. And then it gets worse. Once upon a time, when I was in college, the professor used to tell us, well, don't worry about the federal debt because we owe it to ourselves, meaning that some people are rich and they buy government bonds, other people get the benefits of the government programs, it's all within the happy family.
Right.
Well, that's not true any longer. Half of the federal debt is now held overseas. So these interest payments will not be made to some trust fund at Morgan Guaranty. The interest payments will be made to some Chinese bank or the Chinese government because we are borrowing from China and Japan very heavily. And so the money will not be available for use in the United States, and it will crowd out other things unless we do something about it.
So when you look at this, do you start thinking, you know, how has Japan managed to have their massive amount of debt outstanding for so many years, and it's seemingly, are we turning into that? Is that what's going to happen?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't wish on us the Japanese experience. I mean, they've had a decade of lost growth, there's something about Japan I've never been able to understand. I visited there. The big cities look pretty prosperous. I understand in a lot of the outlying towns, the towns are just drying up because they actually have a shrinking population, which we don't have. But economically, they save a lot of money. And
right.
So most of the government debt in Japan is held by the Japanese. This isn't going to go on forever, but that's why they have been able to get away with this. But in exchange, you find there, I think the younger generation is somewhat, many of the people in the younger generation are without hope and ambition, and that they don't think that life is going to work out for them. And you can see that in all sorts of social pathology that I don't think we wish on ourselves.
Yeah. Now, in terms of, we're coming up on the end of the year. In the end of the year, there's this big discussion of fiscal cliff. Now, so far, many of the things that have gone on in terms of, let's say, for example, them raising the debt ceiling. I mean, there's a lot of hoo-ha beforehand, and then everything was fine, even though we got downgraded as a country and all that. Is this just a big, kind of worry issue, or is it something that's really serious?
Well, first of all, we did raise the debt ceiling last summer, and I don't really care about the downgrade, but I do think it did shake up people a little bit, that Congress and the president were having such a hard time governing that something that traditionally has been an argument about and then you do came very close to not working out. And so it scared people a little bit into thinking, just maybe these guys in Congress are so angry at each other, the system is so dysfunctional, that they might do something crazy, like go over this fiscal cliff to which you refer. So basically what happened is, in order to get out of that contentious situation last summer, they promised themselves that they would cut the deficit by $1.2 trillion over 10 years. They would agree on a way to do that by December 31st, 2012. In order to force them to do it, they said, we're going to point a gun at the head of the U.S. economy, and we're going to set the trigger, so the trigger will automatically be pulled unless we do something else to reduce the deficit at the end of the year. Well, Congress is gone. They're not coming back till after the election. So we have 2 months after the election for them to either find some better deficit solution, some alternative, to drive the country over the fiscal cliff, probably temporarily, or to come up with some fudge that waives the spending cuts of the fiscal cliff and pretend they've actually fixed the deficit. I think the betting is that their most likely thing is the latter, that they essentially take the bullets out of the gun, that it's hard to believe that members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, would do something which they, most of them, believe would be really bad for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to know because if they take it down to the wire, there's always a chance of a miscalculation and we may actually go over the cliff. And they've done some things that make it a little less catastrophic. As I said earlier, they funded the government through March, so the government won't shut down. And the Treasury and the White House Budget Office will have some discretion about how quickly to implement all this thing. What I think is going to happen is as we get closer and closer to the end of the year, there'll be either some serious negotiations and people will say, like, well, they're going to pull it off, or there'll be chaos, at which point the markets will then rebel and say, you guys really are nuts, and that'll force something.
Well, what is the biggest challenge that you think right now to our debt situation and to this deficit and the spending problem? I mean, we have a record number of people, I think, on Social Security disability at this point, and we have an immense amount of spending that's going on for health care, and that's growing every single year. Mm-hmm. Even with Obamacare, that we really haven't seen the
right.
full, the full outcome of what that's going to mean to anybody. But I always say, so far my healthcare costs have gone up every single year, and they're not cooling off at all.
Right.
So what's the biggest issue right now? I mean, what's the biggest concern in terms of our overall?
I think the biggest thing is, and in the book I quote Doug Elmendorf, who's the director of the Congressional Budget Office, which is one of the few institutions in Washington that actually seems to have some credibility. And he likes to say that there's a fundamental disconnect in the country between the services, the benefits that people expect the government to provide, particularly in the form of benefits to the elderly, and the tax revenues that they're willing to send to the government. And so when you cut through all the noise, that basically, in my mind, is the problem. That we have decided as a people that we want an awful lot of benefits from the government, and we're not prepared to elect people who are willing to raise taxes to meet them. And they won't cut the benefits enough to make them meet the revenue line, and they won't raise the revenues enough to meet the spending line. And we've been lulled into a sense of complacency because, as I said earlier, we've been able to borrow a lot of money cheaply.
Right.
People are not going to storm the Capitol demanding that their Social Security and Medicare and farm subsidies be cut and that their taxes are going to be raised. So it's not going to be because people rise up and say we have to do it. It's going to happen either because we have a crisis of some kind, perhaps a financial market crisis, perhaps one of these artificial crises like the fiscal cliff law to which we referred earlier, or there's going to be an outbreak of leadership. And I just can never figure out which one is going to happen first or how long we'll go before we get either one.
Now, there's a difference between Obama's and Romney's approach for how they're going to, maybe deal with this whole deficit issue. Can you kind of
Correct.
Delve into that?
Well, the first thing is that the reason I'm struggling is, to some extent, neither one of them have put all their cards on the table. Governor Romney has been very vague. In fact, his tax plan seems to be morphing before our eyes. So it's hard to know. But he says at the very least, he's not going to raise taxes on the whole. He says he's going to cut spending, but he doesn't identify all the spending cuts, and he's going to raise money spend more on defense than President Obama. He has in mind, definitely, a smaller government than President Obama. President Obama has a little more of a plan on the table because he's the president, but there are a lot of open questions about what he would really do. But one thing's for sure is he thinks we need to raise taxes. He claims we can do it just on the top 2%. And he says we need to spend less on less on defense than Governor Romney does. And he makes the case that that the government spending, a lot of it goes to make the economy better in the long run. So you could say he would have a bigger government than Governor Romney and his running mate Paul Ryan sees optimal.
So is there the whole issue with China that everybody seems to be worried about, which you actually kind of alluded to in the beginning, where you said that. Your professor said that we owned our own debt, right? I mean, there's always been a question that I get, and everybody's all worried about, what if China gets really pissed off at us? You know, what if the situation in China and Japan, where the islands are at risk here, and we have supposedly a written agreement with Japan that we would, be on their side, if you will, and we would protect them and we would be involved in their defense. What if China really got upset with us? Can you kind of focus on that? Because a lot of people have a misconception about that, I think.
Right. I heard Erskine Bowles, who was one of the co-chairmen of the deficit panel that the president appointed and then didn't endorse the report when it came out. And he tells this great story about, so we have a treaty with Taiwan to defend them in case they're attacked by China, which we will probably live up to, but we'll have to borrow the money from China to do it.
That's great.
So I think I think basically, though, we're in this kind of symbiotic relationship with the Chinese, that they have a lot of savings. They manage their currency. Some people call it manipulation. And as a result of that, they end up with a lot of dollars. They don't want to have a lot of dollar bills buried under the Forbidden City. So what do they do with them? Well, they want to buy safe securities. What is the safest securities in the world? The U.S. Treasury. So a lot of that money is in U.S. Treasuries. Some of it is in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper. Some of it is in other U.S. securities. They don't have any interest in sinking our economy because, A, they have a big stake in it now. If the U.S. government actually defaulted, they would lose money. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we are their biggest market, or one of their biggest markets along with Europe, for exports. So they don't want to sink our economy, at least in the short term. And we don't want to be in a position where we piss them off to the point that they put their money in something else.
Right.
Now, there are two things to say about that. One is, I mentioned Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. When you read the book that Hank Paulson wrote, the former Treasury Secretary, and he talks about when they essentially nationalized those two mortgage companies, they took out most of the shareholders, and they took out most of the preferred shareholders, many of whom were U.S. banks. But they didn't touch the bondholders. And one reason they didn't touch the bondholders is because a lot of the bondholders was the Chinese, mm-hmm. and they couldn't afford to do that. But the second thing is that it can't go on forever. And it's not going to end because the Chinese go on strike someday. It's going to end because at some point in the future, maybe Europe gets its act together, although that seemed to be taking a long time doing that, and they decide to put more money in Europe, or Japan finally gets its act together, they put more money in Japan. They don't have a lot of markets now to choose from. I like to say that the U.S. is the world's tallest midget. So we're benefiting from the fact that the rest of the world looks just as bad or worse than we do, so we're still the safest thing. But at some point, that won't be true anymore, and we'll either have some sharp change or maybe even worse. Interest rates will just be a little higher. The dollar will be a little weaker, and we'll have to get used to, like the proverbial frog when the water gets warmer and warmer and warmer, but it never boils. We'll have to get used to it because we can't. It's not a sound national strategy for us to rely on the savings of China, which is a poor country after all, or on the savings of Japan, which is a rich country, which is going to need its savings back because it's going to have so many retirees, as a way to finance our mortgages and our investment. That just doesn't make sense. And the sooner we deal with it, the less likely it is to be catastrophic when it happens.
It just seems to me that everybody wants to fix the problem. I mean, everybody. I don't know anybody that doesn't want to fix the problem, but nobody wants the pain of fixing the problem.
That's right. Washington is, in a sense, in what you might call the post-denial phase on the deficit. You don't find very many people running around saying what Dick Cheney supposedly said is deficits don't matter anymore. I mean, Barack Obama, Paul Ryan, you take your pick. They all are kind of furrow their brow and say we can't go on like this. What they don't agree on is how to apportion the pain and what's the right way to do it so that we have the least amount of pain now and the most chance of coming out of this with a stronger, faster-growing economy. Because after all, the point of all this is not to reduce our debt. The point of all of this is to have an economy that does better over the long term. If you thought we could continue to borrow 1.8% forever, it would be fine. But we can't, so we have to find out something to do about it. And I think after the election, it'll be really interesting to see whether they manage to put aside the campaign rhetoric and say, okay, well, that was the campaign. I can't get everything I want. You can't get everything you want. So these are the things that are important to me. Can we find a deal that gives me the things that are important to me, and you the things that are important to you. And there are, to be fair, a group of people in the Senate of both parties, it used to be called the Gang of Six, but it's kind of expanded, who are kind of exploring these kind of things and may, in fact, come out of the woodwork once we get past the election.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of CEOs that have contributed about $25 million or more so far to a campaign of the deficit, anti-deficit crowd in Washington to try and make it safe for the politicians to do things. But when you listen to what they say now, most of them, and you look at how divided they are and how little trust there is, it's very hard to be optimistic. And I think that's what's scary.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, the book is Red Ink, Inside the Stakes, the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. It's author David Wessel, and it's a quick read. It's great. I think it's a really interesting piece, and I think it's something that anybody that wants an inside look of what's going on and really what the goings on of our money flow from into various places, the automatic money flow, as well as where money's coming from and the potential, I think pick it up. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right, David. Bye-bye. And I mentioned a couple of, actually last show, that we're going to start this week with Stocktoberfest, where we're going to be reviewing the stocks that you have sent us. We put an example up there. We're going to have at the top of the Disciplined Investor at the website there, you're going to see a link that shows you the link to the main page, which is going to list the various stocks that we're going to be reviewing and as well who sent them in to us. Click there and you'll find out the analysis. And what we do there is we look at technical and fundamental factors. Now, these are snapshots. These are where we are today and the trend that we've seen and the potential moving forward. Now, that doesn't mean this is going to be something that is static, that in a month from now, the stock may change its overall rating, where we rate the technicals and we rate the fundamentals. But we look at a variety of different traditional technical factors, and we put in a grading. When we look at the trend, we look at also the fact of where the markets are at and also the fundamentals of the company in terms of their earnings growth, their revenue growth, their momentum in terms of their movement compared to, let's say, 1,500 other stocks. We look at a variety of factors to come up with an overall grade or score. Now, sometimes a stock that may be doing very well has a great fundamental score, and all of a sudden their technicals start to roll over and not look so good. And you get a score on the technicals that's maybe negative or very low. And with the combined score, the combined grade you get is something much lower than you'd want to have. This is a snapshot, a time and place grade for where things are now. For example, when you look at Apple, their fundamentals are just absolutely off the charts. They look great. But what we found when we did it right now is that their technicals aren't looking so good and you'd have a much lower overall and it may come up with a sell grade. Now, I'm going to make sure you understand this, that that doesn't mean that in a month from now, in 3 weeks from now, in 2 months from now, or even in a week from now, that all of a sudden the technicals start to change and it becomes a much higher technical grade and therefore you get a much better overall grade. So when you see this, take that into mind. We talk about inside of the report that we do on each of these, why things are the way they are, some of the history of the technicals and fundamentals. And I think you'd really enjoy it. It's a really good way that we use internally to see what's going on with a stock. And we've put this together over many years to come up with a snapshot in time of what's happening, as well as the outlook for earnings, the outlook for revenues, and the overall potential for a stock. So make sure you go over there. It's going to be every day this month. We already overflowed with amount of requests. That'll happen in 1 week. So we're going to kind of cut that off probably the next couple of days and try to get to as many as we can throughout the month of October. So we appreciate you checking that out. And thank you so much for giving us the your choices of things that we're going to look at. And again, we're going to try to get to everybody's that we can that, has appropriate data that we can actually analyze. So that's Stocktoberfest that you want to look at. The other thing that I'll mention, I was on Frank Curzio's show last week and he had his 150th episode. It was really great. And he had three different guests on, the ones that he has, for whatever reason, maybe his listeners like or whatever it may be, I'd encourage you. We also put a post up on that on the website as well. One of the things that I did last week is every once in a while we look at what's called the Spearman indicator, the trend stall indicator, and now a candle sessions indicator, something they use in Asia. And we put that up on the Disciplined Investor last Monday. And what we saw there was evidence that we had a very substantial, we'll call it overbought. This is not the same as our key reversal indicator. We saw a very substantial overbought situation, and it looked like that markets were getting ready to kind of roll a little bit. Take a look at that. I'll try to update that this week. We're finding now that that same indicator has been reversed, not to a point of like an imminent, you know, move higher, although, you know, it's getting pretty low. But it is at a point that you're seeing that stocks have been sold off enough to consider getting that, you know, a point that may be much better in terms of overall overall buying situation. So right there, you have to look at, you know, how long is it going to take, especially in this market condition where we've seen 4, 5, 6 days down and then a couple of days up that kind of take that all back. And if you look at a chart on a daily basis of the S&P or the Russell, you'll see this kind of jagged move higher, but kind of the rollover for a few days and then boom, pops up, rollover for a few days and pops up. And that's there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, some of it has to do with the fact that investors just want to be in. They're looking for any kind of pullback to buy in. That's okay. But realize that that is the overriding trend right now. That's something you really need to consider and look at. All right, so there's a lot of things we talked about today. I want you to take a look at what's going on with Spain, the bailout that is clearly imminent. They've done all the things that are necessary to get themselves in a position to allow for the ECB to start buying their bonds by making a budget, which seems a little bit ridiculously, I guess we would say it would be very harsh for the citizens. That's why we've seen a lot of the riots. But they're making room for that bailout, and that's what they're doing. We see China starting to show additional signs or continuing to show additional signs of weakening. And, of course, markets are not in equilibrium. Other than that, take a look at the eco this week. Watch the Disciplined Investor. We're going to have a lot of posts coming up on Stocktoberfest. Lots of things to discuss. If you need to find me and contact me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week. Have a good one and a profitable one. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.